Hey everyone, thanks for joining. Today I'm speaking with Stuart Parker. Stuart is a writer. He's also the founder of the Los Altos Institute, which is a think tank out of British Columbia. He does work with the British Columbia Conservative Party and also the Deep Green Resistance. Hi Stuart, thank you for coming on.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I think I'm probably the only person in the world concurrently affiliated with the BC Conservative Party and Deep Green Resistance, but hopefully that'll change. It's very difficult to sort of figure out how to situate oneself in during this political realignment. If one is sort of a person who came out of what we remember as the left of the 20th century.
Yeah, okay. I mean, on that, I was away until 2014, so I was gone for a little over a decade. And I always, if anyone had asked me, I would have said, yeah, okay, I'm left wing or center left or something. But when I came back and I was seeing what was going on, I mean, one of the first things I started saying was these terms have no meaning anymore. Like left, right, liberal, conservative. I've lost all meaning. Canada has what, roughly 40 million people. I think if you ask them, you would get 40 million different answers. And it's so I just started joking around. I said, okay, I support Enlightenment values. I'm an Enlightenmentarian. And then as things went along, I said, okay, maybe that's more serious because it's not no longer a joke because what you talked about political realignment. Yes, okay, the BC Conservative Party and a Deep Green Resistance. Now, I don't consider myself an environmentalist. I don't consider myself an activist of any kind, really, but there's certain things I want to conserve. And yes, I want a healthy environment, but I think, the way someone like Extinction Rebellion goes about it is completely batshit crazy.
Well, and it's not clear, in fact, that that Extinction Rebellion is an environmental organization. Like, if it were to turn out that it's actually funded by British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell, I don't think most people would be particularly surprised. Extinction Rebellion is, in many ways, it's a post-political movement. I'm not sure it even has politics in the traditional sense of the term. Two things that Extinction Rebellion said that I feel epitomize what ails us politically today. One is Extinction Rebellion Bristol issued a statement that if we didn't all agree that trans women were women, the planet was not worth saving and should burn. I found that useful because it sort of shows the realignment of what we've traditionally considered to be environmental organizations that because it didn't just express, this crazy new American space religion they all believe in. It also made it clear that they understand themselves to be hostage takers. It's not so much that they are the environmental movement. They're an entity that has taken the environment hostage and is now making demands on the basis of the hostage taking. But the other thing about Extinction Rebellion that is even weirder is, it has only one demand. And that is that all climate policy be set using something called deliberative polling. So Extinction Rebellion actually has no demands about the climate at all. It simply says that we should impanel focus groups to set climate policy.
And that'll work. Yeah, but okay. So something on what you said there, Extinction Rebellion saying, if you can't agree that trans women are women, then you're not helping the environment or the planet deserves to burn. I mean, I started following you and I got to know your stuff. I think it was John Kay that recommended you, and it was because of the gender ideology, queer ideology, trans rights activism, and all that. But that's. It's whether you talk about the racism issue, whether you talk about trans or the environment or go vegan or whatever, if you're from a certain, I don't want even want to call it far left, but if you're from that progressive woke left, it's all one issue.
That's
that,
right. Everything is everything else.
yeah. And so it's, that's part of the problem. Like, if you're having a debate with a trans right activist, okay, it would more, be more of a yelling match than a debate because they don't really debate, but it's not so much, yes, they'll focus on the trans stuff, but if you start putting them in a corner, then they'll bring in racism. Or there was an article I just read recently. It was like Switzerland, their court agreed that their climate policies were hurting trans women or something like that. It was just ridiculous. Like,
Oh, yes. No, there was
oh.
this great article about, I think it was how climate change in Burma is killing trans-identified Burmese sex workers. And I thought, well, that's awfully specific.
Yeah.
I mean, a few years ago, I was doing some work for an indigenous social service organization in northern British Columbia on this thing called the Highway of Tears, this terrible highway in northern British Columbia. It's a wonderful scenic highway. I love driving down it, but the thing is, an extraordinary number of Indigenous women and girls have gone missing or been murdered there. And there have been four or five government commissions into why this is. They all reach the same conclusion and make the same recommendations. The highway has very little. It at one point had no mass transit service at all. People had to hitchhike to, if they didn't have cars. Now they just have a woefully insufficient amount of transit service, which doesn't stop on any on any. No, that's not true. It stops on one of, I think, 20 Indian reserves on the highway. So there's still no transit service to the reserves. So, Indigenous women and girls end up having to hitchhike, and the highway is full of, they're disinhabiting northern British Columbia. They're getting rid of towns and they're replacing them with man camps, these temporary areas where people do fracking, whatever, their work camps, very sexually violent places, lots of meth, lots of young men, no women. And in fact, scholars in North Dakota have been able to draw predictive murder maps just by knowing where the work camps are for the fracking. So I'm reading all this scholarship about it. And there's good scholarship, but increasingly, as peer review breaks down, I'm doing this big review of all the academic study of the highway, even though everybody knows what the solution is: close the camps, bring back the bus. So they keep cutting the bus service and building more camps, and then funding commemoration of the dead. That's what the government's keen to fund. So I get to this article, though, and it tells me that black transgender sex workers are being killed on the highway. I don't think a black transgender sex worker has ever set foot on the highway. But it's the kind of thing that now passes peer review and gets published in the United States. So people are, and this has to do with what I would say we're dealing with more generally, which is that this thing, this creature that is shambling around in the flayed skin of the left, it's a religious movement, and one of the features of being a most religious movements are ontological dualists. They believe that there is like a real world, and then there is a world above the real world that's made out of ideas, that's immaterial, that's full of spirits and whatever. And increasingly, I feel that the left is not trying to act on this world. It is not trying to change the order on earth. It is trying to describe the order in heaven. It is describing an immaterial world made out of ideas and aesthetics.
Okay, there's something I used to say about this, and I still kind of joke around about it. I'm like, this is the bizarro Ezekiel. So if you know the story of Ezekiel, he pulls back the veil, he sees paradise. These people pull back the veil and they see hell. That's what they're saying, that like the world is out there. But I wanted to talk to you about the how the left's gone crazy. And again, I don't like using the term, but we don't have anything else now.
It's a
From
good
my,
term.
but it's lost meaning, like I said. But like now, I mean, Okay, you and I will disagree about this, but from reading some of your stuff, like you were an old school Marxist, or you still are. I mean, I don't want to say were, but like I said, you and I might disagree about economic policy or whatever. Same thing with like a moderate Christian or a moderate Muslim or someone who's moderately Jewish or any I might disagree with them about what reality is, but at least they agree that there is a reality. Whereas with the progressive left or the woke left or whatever you want to call it, yes, they're pulling back the veil and they're saying we're seeing hell, but it's everyone's own private hell. There is no objective reality, and so whatever someone wants to be a reality is a reality. So it's like I said, I can speak with Marxists. I'm friends with Marxists. We disagree on certain things, but at least we agree that there's an objective reality out there. And that
Right.
makes it a lot easier to talk.
Right. And I think it's quite important here. There are basically so one of the terms that has, because it's opposite day every day on the left, and I'll speak a bit to why I think the term the left remains useful. I'm no longer part of the left. I can't identify into the left. But the thing is, the way they use the term social construction. Now, I know what a social construction is. I went to university during the heyday of post-structuralism. There's some real utility to that stuff. What a social construction is it's when a society looks at the raw materials of the physical world and it constructs a shared social reality out of those raw materials. So when people said gender is a social construction 30 years ago, what they meant was societies get together and they look at biological sex, they look at the labor system, they look at culture, and they construct gender out of it. And the raw materials for that are physically real things like sexed bodies, like childcare, like things like that. But the problem is when you talk to a leftist today and they say gender is a social construction, they don't mean social construction, they mean personal fantasy. It is neither social nor a construction. Yes, you're quite right that what has happened is, right, there's the idea of objective truth, truth that you can simply find by looking at the world. There's another thing called intersubjective truth. So, for instance, what time it is objectively here. Right, it's objectively it's noon when the sun is at its zenith in the sky, wherever you are. But in the 19th century, that couldn't work anymore because you couldn't make a railway timetable doing that. So we made time zones. And so what time it is became a social construction. It was an intersubjective reality. We all agreed that we were in the same reality together, and we all agreed on what time it was, and we all set our watches to that time. And so what we're dealing with the left is something new, right? It's not that they can actually escape this. Of course, they live in a world of social construction. Of course, they live in an intersubjective world. But their ideology denies that. And I noticed this in far right troll culture before it was adopted by progressives. When people go, "You don't know me," it's like, "Well, that was a racist thing to say. You don't know me. You don't know I'm not racist." It's like, "Well, I wasn't. I don't have to know you. If you said the Jews should die, that was racist. I don't actually have to be inside your head in order to know that." But there's this sense then of the sacredness of people's private siloed experience, which has nothing to do with anything other than their private siloed experience.
What you said about the right there, this is something that I kind of focused on, and I still harp about it, and I'm seeing it now. Is I came back from overseas, I saw what was happening, and I said, okay, we're going to get overcorrections, and the overcorrections aren't going to be good. Now we've had a few. I'm going to stick to North America because there's stuff going on all over, but Trump was an overcorrection.
Yes.
Charlottesville was an overcorrection. Then, if you want to talk about overcorrection the other way, like BLM stuff or whatever, then you had January 6th, which was, I think they fed off each other, the BLM riots, and then what happened at January 6th, I think that actually one fed into the other. And so it's like that. But then another thing I said was, and the best way to explain it is this, it's from Man from All Seasons. So, Sky Roper's looking at Thomas More, and he said, "Yo, you're gonna give the devil the process, like the due process of the law." And Thomas More said, "Well, of course I will, but you're the type of person who'd burn down the law to catch the devil." And this guy Roper is like, "Yep, I'll rip out every single law in England if I can catch the devil." And Thomas More is like, "What are you gonna do when the devil turns around and faces you? You've got no protection left." And that's where we are at this point right now. And this is what I was like
Yes.
shrieking out about is the institutions that used to protect us, our civil liberties, or the universities that were sense making, or any of these things, they have become ideologically captured. And now you're getting pushback from the right that's going too far in the other direction. But we have nothing left to protect ourselves from that overcorrection. And it's our, ordinary average citizens are stuck between this, between these two these two extreme ideologies. And
Well, and in fact, in some ways, they're not two extreme ideologies. They are a single society-wide social phenomenon that looks different depending upon the location it lands at. It's certainly worse on the left because the left has taken on totalitarian characteristics that the right has largely escaped. But nevertheless, the fact is that many that what we're dealing with is a society-wide event. And one of the features of that society-wide event is that people now understand that everything is tribal, that having double standards is now understood to be virtuous. The very idea you would apply the same standards to your friends and your foes, is viewed as morally problematic, in the ascendant social movements in our culture. But I also want to get back to Thomas More because I'm very glad you brought him up. I mean, I think there's a lot about Thomas More's life and the way we remember him that's very relevant in our times. One of the jokes I make is that we can tell we're in kind of a shabby version, the first as tragedy, then as farce, Marxist principle, when Tucker Carlson is your Thomas More.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
But that's the thing, right? The left loathed Fox News until Fox News fired Tucker Carlson for platforming the Women's Liberation Front. And Carlson starts putting on socialists and feminists, and suddenly the left is going, "Fire him, Rupert Murdoch! You go, Murdoch! You go!" And it's like, whoa, that's interesting. So that's one of my Thomas More things. But the other thing that has happened to me is all kinds of people, well-intentioned people, who I think are behaving in a craven and disgusting fashion, who remain progressive identified, have come to me and said, "Stuart, why did you stand up against, for those old women they were attacking? Like, didn't you know something bad would happen? Like, you were so stupid to like stand up for women's rights like that. What were you thinking?" And "Stuart, they're only sterilizing the most troubled and disabled children. Why would you stand up for them? There really aren't that many autistic children who are being sterilized. Why would you do that, knowing that you would get into all this trouble? How foolish of you." And there's a line from Blackadder about that, right? The line is, "Oh, if only Thomas More had had the presence of mind to say, 'I recant my Catholicism.'" It's like they can't understand that that's actually like what a moral person is supposed to do, is to accept adverse social and economic and, if necessary, physical consequences for telling the truth or standing up for vulnerable people. But a lot of people genuinely think like, "Oh, you must have You must have had a lapse in judgment. Why would any sane person endanger themselves to protect the safety or liberty of a more vulnerable person? And I find that that is perhaps one of the most disturbing things one finds on the left these days, is this idea that doing the right thing should be consequence-free. And that if there are consequences, one must have done the wrong thing.
Yeah, and I think that's, well, there are a couple of things there. One, what you just said, like, I think that's part of the reason for that is they've made, like, for the smallest transgression, you could have huge consequences. You know, little old, you know, an elderly woman in the UK asking some security guard where she's from. And all of a sudden, this 80-year-old woman is kicked out of an organization she's been in for, you know, decades, right? Like, there's that. And then the other side is, oh, we have to be safe. We have to be, you know, everything's about our own safety and our own protection. So that's kind of creeped into it. And then I think it's self-preservation on, like you said, it is cowardly. It is self-preservation. Like, it's, oh, I don't want to say that because I could lose my job. I don't, and I can understand that to some extent. I don't want to say that because I'll lose all my friends. And so for that's the judgment they've made. And part of that is, again, it was something Douglas Murray had said a while ago. I mean, a long while ago now. Like, people in general, freedom has never been a popular concept. You know, people just wanted to do their lives, be comfortable, be safe. And it was only because of a certain few that pushed, you know, we want our civil liberties, we want our individual freedoms, you know, we want to live as long as we're not harassing everyone else. It was only a certain few. So it's only a small amount of people. So all these people on the left who, you know, speak a good game, and I'm not talking about the very far extreme, I'm just talking about the average everyday person who, you know, I'm for, you know, I support abortion, but I don't support abortion until the, you know, the minute the baby's crowning. Like, you know, I, you know, there's got to be happy medium some places. I think the gun culture in the U.S. is nuts, but I don't want to start banning everything left, right, and center. I think what Canada's doing is a little crazy. So there's, you know, like I said, but no one's willing to talk about that because they are so afraid. It's, they've been cowed into thinking, well, I'm going to lose my job. Like, they, you know, I'm going to be ostracized. And I mean, the amount of people that have gotten fired, the amount of people I've spoken to who, you know, professors who've lost their jobs for admitting that women, you know, men cannot become women, like, and things like that. So the average person sees that and it's, well, it's self-preservation. So in their mind, you doing what you did is the equivalent of, you know, someone cutting off their arm to escape a trap type of thing. Like, okay, that's an extreme thing that you've done. How could you do that? That's not normal. You could have waited for someone to rescue you or whatever. But, and that's, I think that's where that comes from. It's that fear. And I think that's what drives a lot of this.
I think that one of the paradoxes of my experience is, so there's this moment, right, during, there have been 7 cancellation campaigns against me over the past 4 years. The second one was the most extreme. That was the one where I feel actually graduated to the level of a fatwa, because the provincial government issued a statement that I was an imminent physical danger to every child in the city of Prince George, after the editor of the newspaper had smeared me as a serial pedophile. And so I was called a pedophile on the front page of the paper. Then the Minister of Education stated that I constituted an immediate danger to every child in School District 57. And suddenly, my landlord and I are getting death threats because Prince George has one of the highest murder rates, I think the second highest murder rate of any city in British Columbia. And so I ended up having to be, you know, smuggled out of town under cover of darkness because effectively the government had issued a fatwa against me. And there's this moment where Lisa Crute, the vice president of the Hospital Employees Union, says on Twitter, "Oh, we know Stuart Parker isn't a serial unprosecuted pedophile. We just want people to see what will happen to them. So one of the reasons I've faced repeated additional cancellation campaigns is that the wokes in British Columbia actually work to raise my profile as a tactic for intimidating other people into not speaking.
So when you talk about the right as well, sticking with this a little bit, but talking about the right, you know, this is one of the things I was saying since I got back. I did a poli-sci degree in the early 90s. You know, then I went into tech. I wasn't an academic. I wasn't looking at what was going on. Then I was out of the country for, like I said, over a decade. I come back, see what the hell's going on. Then I start reading all, you know, I came across some, you know, post-colonialism when I was in school. I think intersectionality was just starting a little bit. It had been around for a couple of years. So I read a little bit of that, but not much. It was only when I came back and I started reading it and saying, okay, this is crazy. But then I said, then I looked at how it was in where it was in education and where it was in not just higher ed, but like in K-12. And then this is going back to my overcorrection thing. It's okay, even if you're a conservative, so take someone like a Charlie Kirk. Now, I know Charlie Kirk, he went to like Trinity University or whatever, if you would really even want to call that a university. But a lot of the people on the right, like Ben Shapiro talks about going to Harvard. A lot of the people on the right went through this education, and now, especially since it's in K-12, they're being taught to look at stuff in a certain way. And so the tactics you see on the left that you're starting to see more on the right as well. And I'm not saying the right hasn't used them before, because it's a form of fundamentalism, and you've had, you know, all kinds of fundamentalism on the right as well. But their focus of their hatred is different, but they're using the same tactics. And you like, so that fear that you're talking about, like, okay, we're going to do that to show them, like, we're going to attack you to show people not to do it. I think you're starting to see that on the right as well, where they're attacking certain big names to shut other people up. And when I say certain big names, I'm not talking about someone like a Candace Owens. I think Candace Owens has been toxic from the start. But on the right now, you're having people like Tucker Carlson attack other people who are on the right because they're not taking the extreme, like the other side of the coin of the progressive left positions that are coming out of whatever the woke right, as Constantine Kissin says, you know, like it's two sides of the same coin. They're using the same tactic. So it's that fear,
Well, I would argue, though, that there is a difference. There's a fundamental difference, and it simply has to do with sequencing. The right went insane first, right? It went insane in North America in 2009. The left began to go mad in 2013. Very interesting statistics. You see, 2013 is a total inflection point. If you look at mental health stats, suicide stats, economic hopes, it just across the board, 2013, something terrible happens psychologically that we still have yet to fully puzzle out. But the point is that the virus that attacked the right was a more primitive virus. It was not as totalizing in the way it controlled people's minds. It produced a lot of stupidity, a lot of silliness, a lot of reactionary behavior. But I think that because the right was hit with something less virulent, less totalizing, and it was hit first, when the right began to sort of start sobering up about 5 years ago, or some people on the right did, the next problem the right had was refugees, people like me. So I think one of the reasons that the right is not as totalitarian as the left is that refugees from the left keep pouring in and diluting the totalitarianism that I think might otherwise build up there. And furthermore, the totalitarian right simply, it doesn't have the same social tactics. It doesn't have the same forms of control. All you can deliver on the right really are social consequences. There is no right-wing machine to make you lose your job. The economic sectors the right controls are things like petroleum. And not even most of the petroleum sector, just the domestic petroleum sector, the medium-sized oil sector. You don't become unemployable in a whole profession if you're defiant on the right. But I couldn't possibly work at a university anywhere in North America right now. My credentials are useless now. So I do think that there's a difference in the deployment of the two groups. I think you're right in saying that the inclinations of the two groups are not fundamentally that different because it's a single society-wide event that's shaking down in different places in different ways. But I do think that right now, because the left, this thing we call the left, more effectively has far more institutional control in this society. And that's especially true in places that are not, that don't have strong democratic counterweights like the United States and England. The United States and England have a lot of institutional democratic counterweights that places like Australia, Canada, Ireland, Scotland simply don't possess. And so, in those societies, when they become woke captured, the level of authoritarianism the left can enact simply can't be matched by the right outside of places like Hungary and Russia.
Okay, no, okay. I agree with you there 100%. The scope of control, institutional control on the left is a lot greater than what's on the right. I was just talking more about the tactics and the mentality, not like the, they will try to get you socially ostracized. They will try to, they're not going to be able to get your job as quickly as the left. But one thing I will disagree with you on there is a little bit is, and I don't discount the Tea Party. Like all this kind of stuff. You're talking about 2008, 2009 with the right going crazy. But again, I think that comes back to my take on this, and this is my read of someone who read into this after the fact, and like an outsider looking in more or less, was because of the control of the universities, because of the control of institutions, and it was slow. I mean, it's a long march through the institutions. It took a while. But around the early 2000s is when you had a lot of the first or second generation of graduates with the intersectional lens, like PhD and master's graduates coming out, going back into the institutions, going to the government, starting doing the work. You had this stuff build up, and then you had some people on the right who were looking at it, and you could, I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat, conspiracy theory time here. So you had people on the right looking at it and they were reading it and they were trying to stir up their base. So the Tea Party base, I don't think anyone in the Tea Party base, I'm not talking about the leadership, just the average Joe member of the Tea Party, I don't think any of them read Foucault or Derrick Bell or Crenshaw or any of this stuff. But these other people probably read some of it or read, interpretations of it and used that to rile them up. This is what they're doing in the schools. This is what they're pushing. So you got this movement as a pushback to it, pushback to Obama as well. You can talk, I'm sure there was some racism involved in it. It was a mixed bag of stuff. But I think it was a slower and a more calculated move from the left to have that long march going through the institutions, which push the right. But then, I mean, you can go back to the 50s and the 60s where the right, you have McCarthyism, you had control on the right. That's when you had the counter-revolution from the left. I mean, these things have been playing off each other for a long time. I'm just trying to focus on, I basically kept my focus on when intersectionality and CRT really kicked off, how they got into universities, and how we went from, in the 70s trying to combat racism in the 80s, let's treat everyone decently, and then you get to the late 90s and it flips back again to this identitarianism. And so that's where I put my goal. I'm not discounting what's happened on the right. The Tea Party was crazy. Like I said, the whole MAGA movement is just another woke, it's a right wing version of the woke movement. It's
Well, I think that the difference is that both the MAGA movement and the commissars who run the left have luxury beliefs.
yep.
What makes the MAGA movement kind of adorable is that it's mostly populated by people who can't afford their luxury beliefs. That's part of the sort of constant sort of shambolic and bizarre character of MAGA in that people have luxury beliefs and they really get hurt because they can't afford them, because they don't have the social status and power to nurture luxury beliefs without consequence that you see with the commissar class on the left. So yeah, I mean, the thing is, intersectionality is bizarre, right? It was developed in two essays, one written in 1989, one written in 1992. No one paid attention to intersectionality in the 90s because it was stupid. It was a lame theory, and people were interested in compelling theories the post-structuralists had. But starting in the early 2000s, what happened was people, there were no new intellectuals. There were no new post-structuralist intellectuals with cool models for things. And so people moved down to the second tier intellectuals that had been ignored in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. People got into this Deleuze fellow. People got into Kimberly Crenshaw. But the other problem was, of course, the people who got into this stuff were people who had misunderstood French post-structuralism in the first place because they didn't know how to read the texts. They hadn't engaged in any cultural translation of the texts. So from the beginning, this whole intersectionality thing was a cargo cult. And that's why it could so easily be repurposed by the Harvard School of Business when it invented DEI as a subfield in management consulting, right? Management consulting was maxed out as a field. And this diversity, equity, and inclusion thing came along because, quite correctly, management consultants determined that it was much easier to deal with a unionized workforce if you instituted those policies. Because one of the effects of DEI is that before DEI goes into effect in a workplace, all of the complaints a union handles are a worker complaining about their superior in management. You bring in DEI, 80% of the complaints are complaints by workers against people of an equal or lower rank in the workplace. And so what happens is that unions retool all of their staff to engage in the persecution of their own members on behalf of the other members. And that's so effective in breaking workers' solidarity. It's so effective in hobbling unions. It puts a different sort of person in charge of unions who are much more likely to collaborate with management and who in fact see management as their natural allies. And so intersectionality was essentially stapled to a management consulting practice and used as its justifying discourse. Intersectionality, if you actually read Kimberly Crenshaw's stuff, A, the articles are stupid. Yeah. B, she says intersectionality is not a theory. And C, most importantly, you've got to go back and look at why did Crenshaw write? How did she use evidence? What Crenshaw was doing was she was justifying policies by the California government, austerity policies. A feature of Blairite austerity, the second phase of austerity, post-Thatcher austerity, the state has already sold off all of the profitable stuff to the private sector. It's already cut its workforce. The next phase of austerity is to reduce the costs of the expensive parts of the state, like looking after homeless people, looking after mentally ill people, teaching children, whatever. So the way to do that was Blairite governments would co-opt and seize control of advocacy organizations and turn them into parts of the state. So in British Columbia, Community Living BC was an advocacy organization for people in mental institutions. So they closed the mental institutions and they got Community Living BC to look after the people who'd been thrown out of the mental institutions, except they didn't give them enough money to do that. So Community Living BC cut the wages by 70% and supplemented the workers with volunteers and provided a lower standard of care, and then also ceased criticizing government policy because it now was the government. So what Crenshaw was doing was she basically put forward a set of unsubstantiated rumors about how volunteer-run feminist transition houses were racist so that the government of California could take them over and put commissars in charge of transition housing. So one of the things you'll notice in Crenshaw's articles, when she tells all these anecdotes about these white liberal feminists being racist, supposedly, there are no citations. There are no interviews. It's all rumor and innuendo. No evidence backs intersectionality in the first place. It's all just stuff she heard around the water cooler, supposedly.
Okay, yeah, look, I mean, I did a deep dive into CRT and intersectionality, and then I also touched on gender and queer theory, but mainly intersectionality and CRT. I mean, I spent 18 months reading all this nonsense. I read a lot of, I read Crenshaw's papers. I read, Peggy McIntosh's the intersectional knapsack and all that. When I was saying intersectionality came in, and I agree with what you're saying there. No, it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't a lot of stuff, but when she merged, like, okay, so in 89 they had the conference. It was Crenshaw and Delgado. I don't know if Bell was there or not, but Stefanchuk, maybe Matsui. I can't remember all the people who were at that conference in New Jersey, and they gave CRT its name. Now, she'd written her first paper, like I think you said, in 89. What, like, CRT, because of the critical legal scholarship, CRT had more of a foundation, and it was a more of a scholarly foundation. But that's, she merged that intersectional lens into CRT, and so they started looking at it, and so that's what I mean by people coming out with PhDs with a C intersectional background. I don't mean that they were using pure intersectionality. It's just that was the lens that was given. The way I describe it is, intersectionality is the underlying Christianity. Then you have CRT, then you have the gender stuff, then you have all that. Those are all your different sects of Christianity. It's that intersectional lens. Whereas I know in the gender theory and queer theory, it's the opposite of the intersectional lens, where the intersectional lens is how you are oppressed, and the gender stuff, it's how you oppress other people. And those are the different intersections. Like, I see how that all works. But that's the way I kind of see it. Like, so I agree with you. It didn't start really showing its ugly head publicly until the 2000s, but you had people using that lens for a lot of other stuff. They weren't necessarily doing intersectionality, but they were looking at it from that standpoint. And then in the late 90s, I mean, I was saying mid to late 90s, and I heard John McWhorter say, "Oh, it's a, we need to go back to a 1997 mentality," and that's kind of the date I use. You had all these people coming out with, like I said, PhDs in sociology, but they had an intersectional lens. And there's a certain, not all of them, there's a certain number of them, or anthropology or whatever, African American studies, all that kind of stuff. Then they went into government, then they went into policy making, then they went into HR departments. And in the 2000s, that's when you had this stuff really start coming out. And it slowly built up until it came to a boiling point, whatever, 2016, 2017, and now it's just bubbling over everywhere. And that's what I meant by what intersectionality coming in, like at the end
No,
of the
I think
90s.
that's very helpful. Again, I don't disagree. These are just matters of detail. I think it's very helpful that we talk about the date, though, because certainly for me, so this is the point where I will briefly mention that one of the reasons I'm making the rounds of podcasts right now is that if you go to Amazon, you can find my 4-volume edited collection of essays that I started writing in 2008. Still writing, of course, but it's interesting, right? Because I started noticing Canada's descent into authoritarianism in 2008 and sort of started writing my first major essay then. But there's a certain, I see 2015 as an interesting point because from 2015 to 2019, I actively dissembled about my own views because the discourse environment had changed. And I remember this really specifically. So one of the interesting things, and I've chosen to republish my earlier work, even though my views have changed on certain issues, they've evolved, but also because there's this 5-year period where I'm actually lying about some of the things I think. And I want that on the record too, because I think it's really problematic when people make being, I don't want to say that I was courageous all along. I was put in a situation where I felt I had no option but to take some damage and take some risks. But there's this period where I was going along with this stuff. And in 2015, I remember, first of all, people saying intersectional on meeting floors for the first time. That was certainly a thing I noticed. It's like, wait a minute, why are people saying intersectional in public? How did this thing jump the fence of Yale University? Like, I thought this was an adult party game that people were playing at elite institutions. How did this thing escape into society? But the first way it manifested for me was Brexit and Trump. Because for the first time, because something unexpected had happened, the Bannonite right had done something that the mainstream right hadn't foreseen, which was that it had built up opposition to neoliberalism within the right. And so suddenly, the investor rights deals that reshaped the world economy in the 90s, that made the world economy neoliberal, the Maastricht Treaty of 92, the NAFTA Treaty of 92, suddenly voters were getting to vote on these things. And there were all these right-wing people who were really angry about it. And I'm like, well, this is unexpected. Isn't this going to get to vote against Maastricht? Because we've always opposed the Maastricht Treaty, the way it attached your minimum wage to you wherever you went in the European Union, so your country's minimum wage would follow you around, the way it prohibited the re-socialization of government assets. Like, there was nothing in Jeremy Corbyn's platform in 2017 that was allowed under the European Union's constitution. But the point is that, like Jeremy Corbyn, I shut up about the European Union's constitution. I shut up about the fact that I thought people should vote to leave because I was told I was a racist, that to question these oppressive labor deals, to question the infinite portability of capital across borders, to question the use of low-wage foreign workers, was somehow racist. In British Columbia, Harsha Walia had this meteoric rise from this obscure role as running this organization, No One Is Illegal, this, free immigration organization. And in hindsight, it's very clear that she became the head of the BC Civil Liberties Association. She became this major media surrogate because the real estate industry wanted her there, because she argued that restrictions on foreign home purchase was racist. That if you questioned anything crossing a border for any reason, you were a racist. And the idea that people in the Rust Belt who lost their jobs because of NAFTA might have voted for Trump not because they hate Black people or Mexicans, but because they hate NAFTA was inconceivable, right? And so, because I had grown up in a Black family, I had come of age doing anti-racism activism against apartheid and things like that, I was totally cowed by the racism accusations. And I folded. And a friend and I think it's important to recognize that, yeah, this mid to the 2010s is this important period where suddenly we realize that these things that have been cooking in universities, in upper management, in all these places are suddenly loose in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I don't disagree with you. Okay. I agree with you. Your timeline. I might say, like, and again, this is my take on it from, I always say, okay, I'm the frog that was thrown in the pot of boiling water, and everyone else just kind of was like relaxing until it got way too hot and they had to notice. So I kind of use like 2014, but a year or so here or there. Yeah, I agree with like it. Yeah, it didn't come out of the university. I know John Haidt says like 2013, but it was around 2014. I came back in 2014. That's when I noticed it. I'm like, it started seeping out into the general population outside of the asylums that were the universities at that point. But just I was I'm glad you brought up your writing, because that was going to be the next thing I was going to ask you about, because I read some of your stuff in your blog, and I know you've started putting out like, collections of your old essays and stuff like that. But I also noticed that you teach like an online course. I was wondering if the two are related, and if you want to talk more about your writing, or if you want to, go right ahead.
Well, basically, so one of the sane things I did, not because I had great foresight, I look back on some of my decisions And some of them were very fortuitous. So I've done electoral political organizing, and the thing about political parties is they get taken over. They're membership-based organizations, and if you're committed to democracy, then you're committed to your party being able to get rid of you. But when I wanted to create sort of an institutional home for the kind of political analysis my associates and I believed in. So when I came back to Canada, I'd been living in the US in 2012, not knowing the shitstorm that was coming, I incorporated this thing called Los Altos Institute, which has turned out to be a bit of a lifeboat. We're an educational organization that has a set of, sort of pro-enlightenment, pro-socialist principles. We're technically a religious organization. I insisted, for reasons that I didn't understand at the time, that we had to have a motto from the Bible. And that turned out to be very helpful, because what it did was, there is a kind of authoritarian secularism that has infected the left, and it has pushed out people of faith. And so so people of faith who were socialist or, whatever, saw Los Altos as a safer place because it was run by other people of faith, not by militant secularists. So we built this thing, and what we used to do was we ran reading groups for people who didn't have the money, didn't have the life story that to get into universities. And we showed them how easy it was to actually do university level work and have a university level seminar. And so a lot of our original work is organizing reading groups, organizing discussion groups at pubs and bars around Greater Vancouver, and doing sort of grassroots socialist education. As that environment became more hostile, we started doing different kinds of intellectual work. And I began teaching online courses for the Institute in 2020 entirely so I could financially survive COVID. But it turned out that that was actually really productive. And certainly the courses I've taught, they're available on my Substack along with my essays. It's all a one-stop shop now. All the courses we do are released as free courses once they're over. They're not particularly expensive to enroll in, but we try and make everything we do available content at zero barrier afterwards. So, so recent courses, the identitarianism course, the wokeness as religion course, some of the stuff is a direct commentary on the crisis that people who used to be left-aligned face. I like Lior Keith's term for us, the old growth left. The crisis that we face. So some of the courses are for that, but some of the courses are still just old-fashioned socialist education. I've always been a big fan of Tanzania. It's one of the reasons I've ended up here. So the Tanzanians helped, worked with the Assembly of First Nations in Canada in the 70s to come up with this concept called the fourth world. The world of that if there's a third world, which was the decolonizing world during the Cold War, the fourth world was the world that was still colonized. And so we've done courses on that. We've done, global economic history, things like that. So I do some teaching, I do some writing. There's some interpenetration between the two. But, I also love teaching. I was a university professor once, but, obviously you can't be a university professor if the minister of education of your jurisdiction has posted a document to the government's website saying that you're a dangerous criminal on the lam who shouldn't be allowed to teach anyone. But I think that that's also constructive. I think that universities are in such crisis now. They're in the crisis the cathedral schools were in during the rise of the university. Ultimately, the university, the original university, the Sorbonne, was a set of co-ops in the streets of Paris run by people who'd been kicked out of the cathedral schools. So my hope is that Los Altos gets to be that thing. So if people want to check out the organization, we have free reading groups. We have in-person ones in Vancouver. We also do online reading groups. We have a we're running a gender and sexuality group. People think it's all about anti-trans stuff, but actually we just spent last episode studying the gender politics of the barbecue in the 50s. Anyway, losaltos.ca. You can find me, you can find the books, you can find all that stuff there.
All right, great. I mean, thanks a lot. I'll put all the links in the description. But one thing about the religion thing is, yes, okay, I've never been a joiner. I stopped believing in Islam when I was 16. I'm 54 now, so do the math. I just when I got back from overseas, I saw this group, Ex-Muslims of North America. I saw Sarah Haider and I saw Mohammed Sayed, the two founders, speaking about free speech, and I've always been a free speech person. So I said, okay, I'll check this group out, and I joined them. But I was never really part of the atheist stuff or whatever. And I agree with you, like the atheist movement became very hostile towards religion per se, but it was more towards Christianity than it was towards Islam. So with the woke stuff, yes, they're aggressive against religion, but they're very cozy with Islam. I think Nick Cohen's book, What's Left, did a really great job of showing how the Marxist left, once the fall of communism happened, they became more of an anti-imperialist thing and sided with Islam. It's a really good book if you want to look at that link. But I mean, they had that brief falling out. I think you were involved in it, like the Million March for Kids or whatever. So when these Muslim families were
Oh,
involved, like
yeah.
you had the progress, you had the woke left freaking out about Muslims. You had Trudeau telling them that they were being fooled by far right, and then became buddy buddy again, because they could like scream about Israel together. So like I don't think the woke was as aggressive on Islam as it was on Christianity or Judaism. Like they see Islam as an like I break it down really simply. Islam is a brown religion. Christianity and Judaism are white religions. So the brown religions are oppressed and they need protection. That's a very simplistic view of it, but that, in a nutshell, that's pretty much what it is.
Well, in Canada, of course, there's this additional problem, right? Of the church burnings, the
Oh, yeah.
100 churches that have been burned by wokes wearing white hoods, which, this is one of the reasons I popped right out of the left. I just went, look, once you've got people wearing white hoods burning racialized people's churches, you're the Klan. That's what's going on. If you're cheering, but that's the thing. The churches that have been burned, they've specifically targeted racialized people. So I want to suggest that there is something even darker here. That sure, if you're a Sikh or a Muslim or a Hindu and you're brown, then you have some sort of special get out of wokeness free card from the left. But if you are a Filipino Catholic, if you are an Indigenous Anglican, you will be destroyed by fire.
Yeah, because they're apostates. They have taken on whiteness.
That's
They are,
right.
and it was like, I don't know if you saw the video. It was from the latest university protest right now. I think it was UCLA. I could be wrong with the university, but there was a native girl who was holding up a sign that said, "Hamas are terrorists and rape is not resistance." And she got physically attacked.
Yes.
Because she is an apostate. They hate, like, it's. I know the whole woke stuff, it is more of a Protestant thing because it started in Christian countries, but it has a lot of similarity with Islam as well. And the discourse, I find the discourse that happened around Islam is the same discourse you're seeing. It happened previously with the proto woke, and now you're seeing the same thing. Like when there's a terrorist attack, oh, let's not be Islamophobic and attack Muslims. Now when a trans person shoots up a school, oh, let's not talk about the trans stuff because we don't want trans people to be attacked. Let's worry about how this how this trans person is shooting these other people is going to affect the trans community. Oh, let's not bring up black people attacking Asians, because how is that going to affect the black community? Whereas you're not worrying about the Asians being attacked, right? It's the same kind of discourse. And
Yeah,
another
no, it's absolutely, it's a hierarchical thing. And I agree. I think that wokeness, I categorize wokeness as an American space religion. It is from the same lineage as Mormonism, Nation of Islam, Scientology, original Sandinismo. It's a very specific theological structure. There is a supernatural, there's a universe, there's no God, but there is a pre-existent generated soul that is born into your body. Lots of stuff to go with there. And of course, the term woke is an American religious term, right? This is, it was, the first Great Awakening was in the 1760s. The second Great Awakening was in the 1820s, and these people are experiencing the third Great Awakening. But one of the concepts, and this is my big beef with one of my big beefs with James Lindsay, is that Lindsay argues that somehow the kind of Manichaean worldview of the wokes comes out of Marxism, which I think is absolutely false. The Manichaean worldview of the wokes, I can trace its lineage. It comes from Algeria. It comes from the Algerian War of Independence. One of the features of wokeness is that it has imported the Muslim idea of the kingdom of peace and the kingdom of war. And if you live in the kingdom of war, all violence you experience is your fault because you've chosen to live in the kingdom of war. You haven't submitted and joined the kingdom of peace. You wouldn't be experiencing violence if only you were woke, if only you had joined the kingdom of peace, if only you had submitted. And I think that there's a very strong element of that. That's one of the things that ruined liberation theology, was the way in which, because right, for 9 years, the number one story in the newspaper on which Jacques Derrida, Derrida's people fled Algeria, Michel Foucault, all those French intellectuals were nursed, grew up, their political consciousness was formed when the French left had this alliance with Muslim fundamentalists in Algeria in that independence war. And I think that, that we're dealing with wokes who have appropriated that Muslim idea and understand anything that happens to us, any violence they subject us to be our fault because we're in the kingdom of war.
Okay, I mean, I agree with you mostly, but I'm going to put a couple of caveats on that. The way I look at it again is, right, so you t take a look at the Muslim Brotherhood. So Hassan al-Banna, he was it Sayyid? I always get the two mixed up, so please forgive me. And I think it was, sorry, Sayyid Qutb was in the US in the 50s or so, 40s or 50s. Then he went back and he started working with the Muslim Brotherhood, but he imported. Okay, he decried the West, but he liked dressing in Western attire. He liked some of the stuff from there. He also studied Marxism in some of the universities. I'm not saying that was it, but he went back and he incorporated some of the things. And then you have people, some of the things he learned here, and then he helped build about the Muslim Brotherhood. Then you had the pan-Arabism going across North Africa, and like we're all Arabs. And then you had the pan-Islam. Then you had people. Then you had, I mean, you had the Civil War, like what, in the 60s, the Algerian Civil War and the liberation from the French. But you also had people like Fanon writing, which was like proto post-colonialism, And so you had the left. Okay, so you had this come from the West, and I'm not just saying Sayyid Qutb was the only person. There were a few others, but I use him as an example because he helped build the Muslim Brotherhood into what it is. So you had that going from the left, from the West into Muslim countries. Then you had that coming back because you had French intellectuals going there, and you had some other Western intellectuals going to the Middle East and revolutionary, blah, 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 fighting on their side. I mean, okay, just an aside to this. So you had the FLN in Algeria. In Quebec, when you had the FLQ in the 70s, they, when they stood trial, I mean, they took their name because of the FLN, right? How far
Yeah,
in the
I
Bahai
think that's a
Sanan
thing
that.
people don't recognize is just how large Algeria looms in the intellectual development of the Western left.
Yep. And it, but it's, but I go, look, I'm going to go back even one step further and go back over, like over 1,000 years. The golden age of Islam. If it wasn't for the golden age of Islam, okay, you wouldn't have had, or you would have had less thought preserved and then coming into Europe after, the Mongol hordes descended on Baghdad. So you have this flow, ebb and flow of knowledge that came from the Greeks to the Muslim world back to Europe. The Muslim world shut themselves off. I mean, you had Stoicism being studied in India like 1800 years ago, or even like just before Christ. So you had this ebb and flow of information. And so it's always been there that one is built off the other. And unfortunately, when you got to the 50s and the 60s, because of this revolutionary turn that was going on in the West, the knowledge that, Muslims who were from the Middle East, so like Sayyid Qutb, took that some of those re revolutionary thought back to the Middle East to infuse that in there and mix it with Islam. Then you had the leftists in the West seeing that and bring, so instead of going for, enlightenment thought or thought for critical thinking, or you had a more authoritarian form of exchange of ideas that went back and forth.
Have you encountered this economist, Timur Kuran? Very interesting fellow. He background not unlike yours. Secularist, ex-Muslim, glad to be out of the Middle East, glad to be in the West. Really kept his powder dry politically until of his massive turn against DEI about a year ago. But I used to assign one of his essays from the 90s when he was still sort of coming up professionally as an economist. And he and so he decided to use quantitative measures to see if Islam was an inhibiting force on economic development in the Middle East. And so he did this big sort of cross-country comparison looking at various things. And he came away with a very interesting conclusion. He expected to find Islam was an inhibiting force. But he said he actually found that that what was inhibiting, the thing that inhibited economic development was control of the public square. That And he was looking at like Iran versus Iraq. He goes, yes, Iran has abridged people's freedom significantly since the Khomeinist revolution. What you can say in public, the range of discourse, obviously that's abridged, but not as radically as in secular Ba'athist Iraq. And Iraq does worse. And he found all these comparisons throughout the Middle East that, what was hobbling the Middle East was pure authoritarianism, and that religion really was a secondary factor. That if religion was used to justify abridging what the public square could discuss, but he said, no, the thing is, freedom of speech and democracy are error-checking mechanisms. If you shut down a society's error-checking mechanisms, the society will do crazy bad things. And I found that to be very helpful, right? And you always want to admire a scholar who goes into the field and proves the opposite of what they intended to. And I think that there's value in recognizing, yeah, what we're dealing with in with problems of Islam today have a lot to do with the authoritarianism through which Islam is presently interpreted in most states that where that's the majority religion.
Yeah, and okay, look, I mean, I agree with you there. It's not necessarily Islam in itself. It's the censorship, it's the authoritarianism, but it comes under the aegis of Islam. If you go back to,
Yes.
Christendom, it would come under the aegis of Catholicism or, Protestantism. It's whatever ideologies in power is controlling. Like if you, Soviet Union, it was, Stalinist Marxism that controlled the, the discourse, and China was Maoist Marxism that controlled the discourse. So it's, again, go back 1,000 years. So you had the golden age of Islam. You had doubters, people they were atheists. I mean, it is in the Quran to kill atheists, but you had doubters during the golden age of Islam. You had people like Al-Farabi or Ibn Khaldun who questioned Islam and questioned the authority of it. Then you had the person like Al-Ghazali who said, nope, only study that which glorifies Islam and Allah. So that view took over. So yes, then you had the authoritarianism. And anytime you had any kind of enlightenment in Islam was because the authoritarianism pulled back and Islam wasn't forced on everyone. So yes, I agree that
Right.
at
And
the
prior to the 17th century, Islam was more religiously pluralistic than Christianity, right? If someone had said, what's the difference between a Muslim country and a Christian country during that golden age, that 600 to 1300 period, of course everybody would say it would be the Muslim country. Only Norman Sicily permitted religious pluralism. It was the only Norman Sicily and the kingdoms in northern Spain permitted religious pluralism. Whereas religious pluralism, the rights of Christians, the rights of Jews, Yazidis, etc., that was a much more common thing in the Muslim world. And that turn, that switch, where somehow the Christian world becomes more pluralistic, is it's one of the terrible historical inflection points. One of the reasons I love Dar es Salaam is, the Swahili coast is a set of societies that were founded during the golden age of Islam, and they have little vestiges of that old pluralistic social contract in places like Zanzibar, that have largely been exterminated in the core territory of Islam.
yeah, and it's, I mean, like, again, it's wherever you look, but some of the stuff, like, I do push back on all the liberal, like, religious pluralism. Yes, for the time it was, but even, but you still had to pay the jizya. You could
Oh
not, you would,
yeah, no, I'm
lived,
saying in relative terms,
in
not
relative,
absolute terms, in relative terms.
no, relatively, yes, it was much better to be of a different, if you were a different people of, person of the book. You got treated better in Muslim countries than you would have, if you were a Jew in Christian countries or a Muslim in Christian countries, or hell, if you're a Protestant in a Catholic country or vice versa. Like in the Muslim world, you got treated better, but it was nowhere near perfect. Look, I'm getting conscious of the time, and I know it's, your time difference and everything. I don't want to waste your whole day, but thank you very much, Stuart, for speaking with me. It was great. If you have any last words, again, if you want
Oh no,
to
this
push
was a
anything.
pile of fun. No, this was a pile of fun. I hope we get to do it again because in many ways this is just the beginning of a lot of our of a big conversation. I want to say it's a pleasure. I really like being able to hop around and have I it's nice to be able to hop around and know that the person I'm talking with is knowledgeable in the next place I'm hopping to. And yes, this has been a very enjoyable time. I hope we can engage in some intellectual collaborations in the future. I think that
Oh.
there's a very important thing to be written about the shadow of Algeria, and I hope we might do that together.
For sure. I mean, look, I'm just some schmuck on Twitter who likes to read, but feel free to reach out at any point you want. Like it's I enjoyed
We're
this
very
conversation.
anti-credential at the Institute.
Yeah.
We're strongly opposed to credentials.
Yeah. But again, thank you very much again. If you want to let people know where they can follow you, I will, like I said, I'll put the links. And if there's any links you want me to share, please send them to me. I'll put them in the description.
Yeah, I'll send over a document. So thanks again. It was a pile of fun.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and I'll be back.